antifaz que tu maldad. Good afternoon, this is Aaron Fitzpatrick at Heritage Radio Network at the Root of It. We're broadcasting live today, the last day of June, at Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick. Thank you to our sponsor, Vias Imports, fine importers of Italian wine. Thanks, Donato. We're going to start today's show with the recap and the week in wine. Michelin Guides won't be publishing the 2010 guides for Los Angeles or Las Vegas. The move represents a regression for the Michelin Guide, which has been expanding the number of cities it's covered. And the attempt is to be more cognizant of the economic environment. They're taking a temporary suspension of those two cities for 2010. The U.S. rap star Chris Bridges, also known as Ludacris, is launching his own cognac called Conjure, which will debut in July in Norway and in the U.S. in September. His consultant blended 14 different samples, which don't then have a grade. Typically, cognac displays its grade, such as VO, very old, on the bottle. And because it compromises so many different grades, it won't be labeled as such. This is unusual for a high-end blend, and after a 15-year boom, sales of cognac are in decline. In the U.S., the drink's leading market, they were down 22% year-on-year. Perhaps Luda can contribute to an upswing. A U.S.-based conservation organization has called for a boycott of South African wine following the shooting of over 40 beached whales near Cape Town. Paul Watson, head of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, further demanded that winemakers step in and force the departure of the director of South Africa's Marine Coastal Management, who reportedly authorized the shooting of the whales. South African wine producers expressed outrage at the ban because, as it's one of the most visible South African exports, wine that is, it's rightly being questioned as to what it has to do with the shooting of the whales. And lastly, just in time for summer, Trek and Eat has launched a new red wine in the form of powder. Wow. Mountaineering gourmands no longer have to forego a glass of red wine after conquering a peak. The beverage powder comes in convenient portions, packed with an alcohol content of 8.2%. Can't imagine that being very good. We're going to take a quick break. My guest this afternoon is Jonathan Russo from the Organic Wine Journal. And we're going to speak today about a bunch of things. Conventional, organic, biodynamic wines, and it's going to be a two-part segment. So this week we're going to focus on the general breakdown of the organic and biodynamic wine industry, and then go into the luxury of ethics and the ethics of luxury with respect to wine. Be right back. Welcome back to At the Root of It. This is a song from the new Moby CD, Wait For Me, which is just released today. And for our listeners who are just joining us, my guest this afternoon is Jonathan Russo of the Organic Wine Journal. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you, Aaron.
How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm very well. A little hot, but we're going to have a good time anyway. We'll take showers afterwards.
Exactly. So before we get into deep conversation about wine, I'd like to just give a little briefing to our listeners about your background and how you got involved in the Organic Wine Journal and in this industry.
Well, I was kind of lucky, I think. I was a product of the 60s. I graduated high school in 1969, so I'm a real Woodstock baby. And I did grow up believing that anything anybody told me was probably an absolute lie, and that anything that I was, you know, being forced to learn from mass media or the mass culture was probably deceiving me. So I was always of an independent bent, having, you know, grown up at that period of time. And then I was very fortunate to have gone to college in Boston in 1970. And I lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1970. And it was a revolutionary time. And this was way before everybody got into organics. But there was a whole movement at that time to have organic farms, believe it or not. There was a store called Erewhon that was in Boston that was all about biodynamic eating or macrobiotic eating, macrobiotic eating. They were, my friends lived on communes and grew all of their own food in 1970. I don't think I ever went into a McDonald's or ate a fast food burger in 15 or 20 years. These things we grew up with in a very, it was a revolutionary thing to then to disconnect yourself from the food chain. Mm-hmm. And when I was in college in Boston, in Cambridge, I actually started farmers marketing in the Haymarket. And I would go down to the Haymarket and buy farm produce from, at that time, it was really being only sold to ethnic people. You know, first-generation Americans who were used to fresh food. So I knew a man who sold chickens. I knew a man who made, you know, who sold eggs. I knew the cheesemakers and the vegetable growers. And that's how I began to eat. And I started feeding all my friends and throwing dinner parties. This was early locavore, early sustainable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're talking a long time ago now. So I came to the interest in organic wine and organic food and locavore cooking early on and naturally. And that was part of it.
Interesting. So you must, it must have been interesting for you to see this whole cycle now that we're kind of 360 since...
It is. It's so gratifying, and it is fascinating to do that. I also had the benefit of tremendous amount of European travel. I would depart for Europe in early May of every year while I was in college, and I would rent a van or buy a van in Dam Square in Amsterdam. And my friends and I just went camping. And, you know, camping in Europe in the early 70s was $5 a day. And wine was all local then. There was, you know, there just wasn't mass wine to buy. You would go up to a farmer or a farm stand or a store, and they didn't have labels on the wine. You would drive up to a little shop, and, you know, there was a wall of wine, and it was like, you know, three or four lira at the time, or, you know, whatever the currency was, marks, lira, francs. And the food was all local. This was Europe in the early 70s was much more like Europe in the 30s or 40s in terms of local farming. And we would buy all of our farm, our produce in Europe fresh. And the chickens tasted like chickens and the eggs tasted like eggs. And, you know, the vegetables were the right color and they tasted right. So my European exposure really influenced me tremendously as to, you know, the concept of terroir and local, and what tasted right at the time. That was a benefit.
You hear that from a lot of Europeans. They say, what's the big deal about this whole movement here
we'll
in the States? This is how we've lived for years.
We will
talk
about
that. That's all we know.
That's exactly right. And we will talk about that as it relates to organic labeling, because you're quite right.
After Boston, you came down to New York then?
Yes, I came back to New York. I was originally from nearby New York, the suburbs of Long Island, and I came back to New York and began a career in the advertising industry here in the city in 1973, exactly like Mad Men on television. This was the tail end of people going out, including me, and having two and three martini lunches. People smoked all the time in the office. You know, everybody was having an affair with everybody. There was no sexual... sexual harassment concerns. It was a very heady time in the advertising business. And then, you know, it came to a crashing halt in about 73, 74, when the recession rolled around and New York became very gloomy. But I did live in Soho then. I lived in a loft in Soho. And then in 1975, I lived in a loft in Tribeca. So I was always pioneering things and pioneering. That was the downtown neighborhood that kind of like gave us Dean and DeLuca, opened on Prince Street, I believe, you know, in 1976 or 77, I knew Joel, and that was in my neighborhood. And there was just a lot happening downtown in the...
Was Raoul's there yet?
Raoul's. I actually went to Raoul's before it was Raoul's. It was a Italian joint run by some family since the 1920s.
Great.
And yes, I saw Raoul's get, saw the neighborhood get gentrified, and I was Raoul's the first day or week it opened. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's exactly the kind of pushing the envelope that, sure, that downtown was. So yeah. I was downtown and have been downtown, you know, for 36 years now.
Very cool. And then you also became involved in slow food. And
I did. I became involved in slow food. I always had the good fortune of being in New York with an expense account,
uh-huh,
from any one of the major advertising agencies, and then the William Morris agency, and then for the last 25 years, my own agency. And I've had that benefit of just liking to eat out and living in the city and, mm-hmm, not being in the suburbs and having the wherewithal to be able to do that, the blessing of being able to do that. So I've always just been interested in food and wine in New York City. I've always just, you know, known what's going on in restaurants and food and wine. And that brought me to the James Beard Foundation, which I worked with for many years and was their agent for a few years when Peter Kumpf was alive. And, mm-hmm, I saw how the artisanal movement grew and the locavore movement grew. And I have a fortunate experience of being out on Eastern Long Island, so I know many of the people in the Eastern Long Island sustainable movement. That brought me to slow food because I clearly saw that was the direction to go. I stopped being interested in being a gourmet,
right,
a gourmand, whichever, and I wanted to be more ethical and more in tuned with what my eating choices were. So I became an early patron of slow food, mm-hmm, and got to know Patrick Martins and Carlo a little at this from slow food, and just became involved in slow food. Also with slow food in East End, I threw a guerrilla party many years ago for the East End Convivium when Michael Alan Katz came by and spoke us. Yeah, and this was before it was officially launched by Ted Conklin, and he's doing wonderful things. But Alan came out and spoke. We did a wonderful event at an Oldfield, which is a tiny little winery on the East End of Long Island, and they do everything sustainably. And we had a return to terroir lunch over there in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just been involved in those movements for a long time. I've written for The Snail on artisanal coffee growing in Chiapas, and I've written some other articles for some other publications, and I just try to stay involved in this industry.
I love that you use that term, return to terroir, because I think in 2008 it had a rebirth, a renaissance, that terminology.
It sure did.
Yeah.
It did. It really has, yes.
So you're interested in the slow food and changing that idea that a dinner party and you have an expense account, you can have whatever you want at your table, regardless if it's in season or out of season, and then becoming more cognizant of what was and what wasn't and
well, things for, locally. Exactly. For a long time, the excitement of eating for everybody, or not everybody, but most people, the excitement of eating in New York was Balducci's.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it had the most amazing produce, sure, the most amazing fruits and vegetables.
And they were mushrooms, I hear.
Mushrooms.
Those were hard to find than they are now.
It was. And exactly. And Balducci's was just a remarkable, you know, experience, but it wasn't local and it wasn't sustainable. It was just the best that they could source.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's shifted to something else. We're no longer happy to eat, you know, mangoes in February. And we don't want to eat tomatoes.
Going to six different stores to get produce to cook at, just because each store does it, or the market does it that much better.
Exactly, or the farmers markets.
Yeah.
So what happened, though, to the Organic Wine Journal, to your question, was the rise of the organic food movement was just, you know, self-evident. I mean, it was already well underway when I think we launched the journal in 2006, I think it was. Editor-in-chief Adam Morgenstern would probably know a little better, but somewhere around 2005, 2006, I think we launched it. I just perceived that there was absolutely no source whatsoever for organic wine, biodynamic wine, natural wine information, period. There would be an article here or there, or a tiny little, you know, I don't even know if there were websites about it, but there was nobody fulfilling the role of being the information source. And we quickly decided that it had to be online only because it's a global movement. It is in Chile.
Right.
It is in Argentina. It is in South Africa. It is in Australia and New Zealand. It is in the Rhone. Mm-hmm. It is in France. It is in Germany, Austria, you know, Spain, and Italy, as well as Sonoma and Napa. So it's global. And I wanted to be able to have a grower in Argentina write something incredible mm-hmm. about a Malbec crush of organic wine that he was doing on Monday. And by Monday, 2 seconds later, somebody in Australia could read that post.
Right.
And you can't do that with snail mail. I mean, I imagined mm-hmm. trying to have that article sent, you know, even by email, to a New York printing house, writing it up, publishing it, printing it, and mailing it to Australia might be like, you know, even with the most advanced technology in the world, yeah. still might be a month and a half before, or 2 months before, you know, that Australian person could read about the Argentinian Malbec crush. So the web,
and then respond to it. I mean, the beauty precisely. Of the internet is the forum of it all, you know?
Precisely.
Yeah.
So the precisely. So the web and this global movement, which is very, very tiny, so it isn't big enough to sustain a real magazine, really gave rise to the Organic Wine Journal.
Great. Well, I would love to hear, and I'm sure our listeners will as well, more about the function of the website and the differences between natural, conventional, organic, and biodynamic wine, which we're going to tap in the next segment. We're going to take a quick break and be right back. Welcome back to At the Root of It. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick here this afternoon at Roberta's Restaurant with Jonathan Russo. And we just got a little introduction to how the Organic Wine Journal sprouted back in 05-06. And where it is today.
Well, I hope we're trying to fulfill our mission of being the go-to source of information. We pay Google every month to get a favorable listing or whatever mm-hmm. they call it. In their search. So if you search organic wine, I think we come up three or four, and the other people ahead of us are selling you something. We're not selling anything right now. We're just telling you about information. It's a magazine, I hope. At least I think it's a magazine. We have mm-hmm. reviews. We have articles. We have editorials. We have interviews. We have pictures. We have features. We have video. We've got some very clever people doing video for us. We've got, you know, travel articles. We're naturally encouraging people. You know, we don't have an editorial staff that is full time or
right.
even half time. So we would like, you know, people to write to us from all over the world and tell us what's going on in their experiences. But, you know, it's a traditional, you know, information source. You can also learn a little bit about various wineries. We have a database. You know, you can find out some things about that. But there's some serious articles in there about, you know, the issues at hand. Sulfites, non-sulfites, organic, biodynamic, conventional, natural wines. We try to demystify and explain some of this. And, you know, sometimes we have some fireworks from people writing in. There's some, you know, there's some argument and fights and screaming and yelling, you know,
well,
amongst the
thing.
I guess so. Controversy, you know, like all industries, you know,
tension always,
you talk to 10 winemakers and, you know, they all tell you the other nine are, you know, putting cow's blood in their competition's
right,
wine.
Right.
But it's very funny. But we're trying to raise the awareness and then the consciousness and then certainly, you know, certainly the ethical reason why biodynamic and organic wine drinking should be an everyday occurrence and conventional wine drinking should be on the wane.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're doing at Organic Wine Journal, trying to do it all.
That's great.
On a very limited, non-existent budget.
Mm-hmm. And you're self-taught in this particular area of expertise?
I am. I am not a trained sommelier. Uh-huh. I've just been drinking wine since I was 17 in New York State in 1960-something. You could drink legally at 18, so you shave a year off of that. I had a Pinot collection in 1967, so I've been at it a long time, but I am not a professional anything. I am a talent agent by trade, and this is a labor of love.
Uh-huh.
I am not a professional editor. We have one of those, and we have a professional business manager. We have one of those, so I'm just trying to put it all together.
I imagine you've spent enough afternoons on vineyards before.
I have.
Yeah.
I have. I've tried. I definitely have.
One-on-one with winemakers can give you the knowledge that you can get in months of reading books.
I have. I've tried.
Yeah.
But I don't hold myself out as an expert. I just have a good layman's understanding of the issues and what's going on here.
Well, to start at the beginning, before we get a little bit deeper into specifics, I wanted to give our listeners a quick rundown of the differences between these different standards of winemaking, and how then for the consumer it's communicated on your purchases, on your labeling, things like that. So starting with, I guess, the basic kind of natural conventional style, which is a little more hands-off but not quite so...
Well, actually, conventional winemaking is, as we know, is a free for all for whatever goes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's it could be pesticide laden, it can be herbicide laden, it could be fungicide laden. Primarily, it means that the grapes in the field, the product that goes in the wine, can be treated as an agricultural commodity,
mm-hmm.
and with all the toxins and all the byproducts of an industrial
standard. Yeah.
Whatever it takes to grow the grapes,
right.
cheaply or as whatever is possible that the grower wants. That's more or less what conventional wine is, and you buy that and you buy it at your own risk, because in the European Pesticide Action Network study, which is we write about on the Organic Wine Journal, we have a whole article about that. It was a hugely popular story in Europe about 7 or 8 months ago, and of course got no play in the United States, but they found 21 toxic carcinogenic products in conventional wine in Europe. They found 21. I mean, they knew what they were. They labeled them. They called
nice.
It out. Well, it's not, if it's in the field, it's going to be in the grape. And if it's in the
right.
grape, it's going to get crushed and it's going to be put in your bottle. So,
right.
When you toast yourself a glass of conventional wine, there could be any number of toxic chemicals in that glass of wine. It doesn't sound very celebratory to me. They did this against organic wine, and they found one trace of one particular chemical in the organic wine, and they then found out that it was like blown over from a conventional winemaker field.
Mm-hmm.
The wind had carried it over,
yeah.
and so one out of 20 had found in like all the other wines sampled. So it was a pretty good study. It was done by a scientific organization that's totally credible, and it's totally accepted. So conventional wine is basically wine grown just like lettuce,
right.
Conventional
like you go
lettuce.
To the grocery
yeah,
store,
that's
you see
right.
your grapefruit,
right.
it says conventional.
What is what it is.
Yeah.
The next level up, if you will, if you want to do a level system on this, more or less, is probably organic wine. And organic wine, at least in the United States, just means that the grapes were grown organically. It doesn't mean that there aren't some additives in the Wine isn't labeled with exactly what's in it, so we don't know exactly if they changed the color a little bit, or if they changed the viscosity a little bit, or if they did other fining techniques to make it flavored in a certain way. There's a pharmaceutical cabinet of doctoring agents that the vintner can buy. There are companies that sell flavorants that to make things more or less tannic, more or less acidic, boost some of the other flavonoids. That can be added to, quote, organic wine. Hopefully it isn't. You kind of have to rely a little bit on the integrity of the winemaker and the company doing that. And, we're hopeful that that people aren't doing that, because mm-hmm. people who are choosing to buy organic wine shouldn't be given an adulterated product, and probably in 90% of the cases they're not. But it just means that the grapes are grown organically. So that's what organic wine is, and of course that has tremendous, wonderful implications. You're not
right.
poisoning yourself, you're
mm-hmm.
not poisoning the world, you're not poisoning the earthworms, you're not poisoning birds, you're not poisoning field workers. I mean, it's a
sure.
wonderful thing to grow grapes organically. The next step up might probably be considered what they call biodynamic wines. And biodynamic is a very complicated, very hard to do process of growing anything. Europe has thousands, 54,000 biodynamic farms. It's a process of that was invented in the 20s by a man named Rudolf Steiner. He was one of the foremost geniuses probably in the Western world. He wrote books, you know, he started the Steiner schools, or the Waldorf schools, one of the two. His writings are about 4.5 linear pages, feet, excuse me, on a bookshelf.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
all sorts of topics.
Yeah. He's a philosopher, he's an economist, he was a futurist. But he came up with this idea of biodynamic farming in response to the poverty of the European fields, especially after World War I. And he just wanted to have self-contained farms, mm-hmm. Aaron, that did everything in a holistic manner, so that you had animals and the animals ate cover crops, and the cover crops protected the fields from depletion, mm-hmm. and then the manure from the animals was recycled to grow more vegetables.
Right.
Things were put in fallow for a period of time. There's a hocus-pocus element that everybody loves to make fun of, but I don't think it's really that humorous, you know, having to do with lunar cycles, which I'm sure, are completely legitimate.
Buried cow horns.
Yeah. For some reason, this is just, you know, like beyond the source of humor to many people. I respect it enormously. I think mm-hmm. that biodynamic farmers are amazing people, and that is one step up, if you will, because it's not monoculture. You have to grow this very carefully.
Right.
It is all certified by a company in the United States and worldwide called Demeter. So biodynamic wines have to have a little label that says Demeter certified.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you can't use it. I believe Demeter even has the trademark on the word biodynamic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very real, very serious term. You cannot use it loosely or just say, oh, I did this biodynamically and mean it. You know, if you do that, you can do it, but you're doing it against what Demeter and other people are intending it to do. There's no reason why you can't grow things without their approval, but it does have its own certification.
Recognized.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
I can only tell you also anecdotally about 20 years ago, I went to Hawaii for a birthday, and I was in Hawaii for a few weeks, and I got to go up to a biodynamic farm somehow. It was advertised to go up there. It was on Kauai, and my wife and I went up to this biodynamic farm, and I had never seen a biodynamic farm before, but the vegetables and the produce actually just jumped out at us,
mm-hmm.
grabbed us by the throat, and said, aren't I gorgeous?
Yeah.
Aren't I beautiful? They glow.
Stunning.
They glistened. You didn't have to be high. You could see the energy coming out of these
mm-hmm.
vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
It was the lettuces. They were growing fruits and vegetables, specifically the lettuce, I remember. I will never forget that as long as I live, because I understood it. That he was growing it in triangles, in threes to get the energy fields together.
You know,
if you ever saw biodynamic produce grown, you probably could never eat anything else. It literally says, advertises itself as being amazing.
Well, it goes hand in hand as well with lower yields and in quality, the vines are very healthy, and whether they're for fruit or for grapes,
right, or any other, or any or any other, or any other product that biodynamic. It's just an amazing thing, and you know, you don't need the you don't need the pesticides.
No,
you don't need the fertilizers. Mm-hmm. You don't need the herbicides. It's all done holistically. And then the last category is called natural wines,
mm-hmm.
and that's very amorphous and very loose, because there's no like certification board, or there's no government standards. There's no Demeter for this at the moment. And what it really seems to be is this, as best we can glean, and I'm sure there are people out there probably going, that's not it, Jonathan, it's this. You know, and you're probably right, it probably is this. But it's just completely natural from picking to
bottling.
As one person, I think Tony Cottori of Cottori Vineyards in Sonoma, Glen Ellen, Sonoma, California, says, it's just grapes. All it is grapes.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing allowed in it. There's no additives. There's no fooling in the vineyard.
No human intervention that's going to transfer.
That's exactly right. Natural wines, just grapes,
mm-hmm.
and you know, fermentation, and nothing else. So those are kind of like what the categories are, more or less.
Wonderful. Well, I think our listeners probably can understand why we're doing a two-part segment with you. next week, we're going to speak more about the industry and how it's grown and where we're at right now and what consumers are looking for. And more importantly, the luxury aspect of it, the ethics of that part, how we're looking at this product and how it's changed our mindset, I think, when we go into a store and we're confronted with it. And oftentimes it's not necessarily positioned well. It could be next to kosher wines that have some dust on them. But why? You know, why is that? So we're going to close today, but thank you so much for your time this afternoon. And we look forward to you having
you
here next
welcome.
Week.
Thank you very much.
So we'll sign off today. Thank you again for VS Imports. This is At the Root of It. And thank you to our producers, Lorenzo Ragioneri and Jake Inslee. We'll see you next week.